Hi, you're listening to History of Gore, a haunted fairground ride through the weird and uncanny parts of the past. And I'm your cannibal carny, James Hall. Firstly, an apology. It has been too flipping long since we last recorded an episode. I don't know why I'm saying we, there's literally only me. I guess that's just optimism. Sadly, I was ousted from my job on All About History and History of War magazine by my own homunculi, who were grown in a jar by a wizard using a potato and my discarded toenail clippings. So I've been a little bit busy. Please forgive me, mea culpa. But the upshot is that this podcast is now blissfully untethered from corporate bullshit. Not that it was particularly tethered to corporate bullshit, because they honestly didn't care. But anyway, look forward to more guests, more co-hosts, and more off-the-wall topics. Pretty much all of February and a good chunk of March, I've been knee-deep in the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879, and I've written well over 100,000 words on the subject for a special edition magazine, which is available now from shop.keypublishing.com. Just search Zulu, and that's key as in the thing you put in a lock, not key as in the place where boats go to dock. Oh, that rhymes, that's nice. Now, best known for the Sunday afternoon movie of choice starring Michael Caine and Stanley Baker, the real Anglo-Zulu War was more than just a defiant defence of Rorke's Drift by 100 crooning Welshmen. It was a cynical attempt by Britain's colonial masters to try and crush the most powerful black kingdom left in sub-Saharan Africa. The bastard British catastrophically underestimated their opponents and faced a crushing defeat at the Battle of Isandlwana before eventually defeating the Zulu and pretty much transforming Zululand into a post-Iraq invasion failed state. Now, what leapt out at me from working on this special magazine, which I urge you to check out for more context, not just because it's incredibly informative, but because I'd like to keep getting work, is that the Anglo-Zulu War was pretty gruesome, and that the Zulu way of war was shaped by the supernatural. Much of what the British saw as being barbaric atrocity was actually a window into a complex, albeit visceral, cosmology. Now, I know I've talked about myself quite a lot here, but stick around, because we've got vengeful ghosts, mass vomiting, and a snuff box filled with semen coming up. Partly to emphasise the quote-unquote barbarity of the quote-unquote natives, as well as because they actually happened, atrocities do loom large in the British accounts of the Anglo-Zulu War. These descriptions are so raw and so unrated VHS cut of Cannibal Ferox that some cranks still believe that Jack the Ripper might have actually been a Zulu warrior, padding softly through the smog of Victorian London. Trooper Richard Stevens, Natal Mounted Police, and one of the few white survivors of the Battle of Isandlwana, wrote, "I stopped in the camp as long as possible and saw one of the most horrid sights I ever wished to see. The Zulus were in the camp, ripping our men up, and also the tent, and everything they came across with their assegais. They were not content with killing, but were ripping men up afterwards." A more extreme and not entirely credible account comes from Trooper Thomas Henry Makin of the 1st King's Dragoon Guards, who visited the site of the battle months later. He wrote, "The first we saw was a little drummer boy, his chest broken in, his head cut off and placed in the chest, his hands inserted below his ribs. We then came across the poor fellows laid in groups of 5 and 6, every one of which had been mutilated by those savages, and all were laid naked, every article of clothing having been torn off them. We came across a large wooden structure like a double scaffold, where 2 other boys had been hung up by their hands to the hooks, and as they decomposed, their bodies had fallen to the ground where they lay, with no friendly hand to give them a decent burial." Firstly, to put your mind at rest, obviously putting your mind at rest is relative, but I'll do what I can. Boys are rank, and it doesn't mean that the victim was an infant. Makin's account is impossible to verify, and it was published many years after the fact. But the fact that it took hold in his imagination, as well as the imagination of anyone else that read the thing, can be seen as testament to the things that we do know. We do know that the British dead were stabbed multiple times after they fell. We know that they were stripped naked or near naked by the Zulu, and we know that they were brutally disemboweled and in some cases had body parts hacked off and carried away. There are three distinct Zulu rituals that resulted in the mutilation of fallen foes. Ukulamula, the first ritual, was a post-battle kind of bonding exercise almost, designed to bind the Zulu warriors together as a fighting unit. Men who fought side by side would symbolically claim part of the kill by stabbing the dead man with their ikwa, the signature short stabbing spear, said to be named after the wet sound of the blade entering ik, and then being withdrawn kula from its victim's flesh. This practice wasn't limited to warfare. Zulu involved in a hunt would enact the same ritual once their prey had been killed. And it's kind of, you know, a symbol of the kill not belonging to an individual, but belonging to the group, and it being a group exercise and a group achievement. And of course, the Zulu esprit de corps and the Zulu sense of kind of camaradership and regimental pride, for lack of, you know, a better description, was part of what made them such an effective fighting force. So, you know, make sure you pick up that magazine, What I Worked On, to find out more about it. Now, the act of Ukulamula explains the multiple stab wounds observed on the bodies of the fallen of the Sandalwana and the other battles of the Anglo-Zulu War. Now, the second act of mutilation, which is the ritual disembowelment, was known as the kaka, and its aim was to protect the warrior from the negative spiritual consequences of taking human life, which is not what you think of when you think of a warrior culture. You imagine that, you know, if anything, they care less about the taking of human life. Now, Miana, which means simply darkness, was a malevolent supernatural force that was unleashed by bloodshed. And it prowled under the cover of darkness. And that's one of the reasons why the Zulu rarely fought by night, and why the attack on Rorke's Drift, depicted in the film Zulu, began to fade in intensity once the sun had set, and then just peter out into nothing. Now, in order to shield the warrior from the baleful effects of Myanmar, first he had to remove an item of the dead man's clothing and wear it until he had undergone the necessary cleansing ritual in his home village. This explains why so many of the fallen British are described as having been stripped naked or near naked. Now, until this warrior had been cleansed, he was referred to as Zilla, and he was kept apart from the rest of society in a sort of spiritual quarantine until he'd been cleansed. He wasn't allowed to undertake any of his normal duties, he wasn't allowed to go near the cattle or the women or the children, and he lived in a, you know, a hut apart from the village. Now, when African tribes fought amongst themselves, this made campaigns quite short and sweet affairs, as the men would fight, kill, and then disappear back to their own communities to be cleansed of the lives they'd taken. So, you know, it would last a couple of days. You'd get two groups of warriors just having at one another. They'd all kind of peel off and undertake the necessary rituals, and the matter would be settled. It was a kind of weird balance to that. But while facing white foes in the Anglo-Zulu War, this sort of thing actually gave the British some breathing space, as the Zulu's most experienced and most blooded fighting men had eventually retired from active duty as they simply wandered off and went home. Now, once the enemy had been stripped of his clothes, he was ritually disemboweled. Under the hot sun of southern Africa, the dead quickly decayed and bloated with the release of gases. Now, the Zulu believed that this bloating was the dead man's trapped spirit who was unable to break free from his stomach. And unless the desperate spectre was released by slicing him open from sternum to groin, the vengeful ghost would follow the warrior home, bloat his own stomach, and eventually drive him mad. Now, the third and final act of ritual mutilation is perhaps the only true act of mutilation, in that it was designed to separate parts of the body for use in Zulu medicines. These aren't medicines as in, you know, aspirin, but these are strange brews, powders, and other mystical concoctions that were mixed together to release their magical properties. The body parts of particularly formidable enemies were believed to aid the Zulu in battle, and there was a special caste of Zulu witch doctors responsible for the preparation of war medicines. These war medicines were called intelezi, Different body parts had different properties, such as the rectum, which would blight the enemy with both fear and explosive diarrhea if the rectum were mixed up with whatever else and scattered over the Zulu warband before battle. Animal products were used in war medicine too, both as a protection for the warrior and a curse on his enemies. Shaka the Great, the founder of the Zulu kingdom, was said to have drunk the blood of a black bull for strength, while another story records that some earth from the ground where an enemy tribe had danced was mixed with animal feces and used to poison their drinking water. Now, to be fair, that worked, but it worked because of the bacterial rather than sorcerous properties of dung. A description of Zulu warriors being administered their war medicine was published in 1857, 2 decades prior to the Anglo-Zulu War. It describes a decoction, which I'd never heard before, and that's a new word on me, but it means essence. Apparently, you know, this particular decoction must be a solid rather than a liquid, but it most commonly refers to a liquid. The decoction was made from a slain bull, which was thrown in the air and caught by the warriors. It would slip it into their mouths like a communion wafer. The war doctor then took a root or medicine stick from the fire and he blew the sparks out over the warriors, who were then directed towards the bush and forbidden from washing. The next day, the warriors drank a potion and then vomited into a large hole in the ground before a ritual call and response chant breaks out between the war doctor and his followers. Further scatterings of powdered medicines followed, which the warriors rubbed into their bodies to render them invulnerable, visible, super strong or fast or whatever else. Mass vomiting ceremonies appear to be quite a significant thing in Zulu spiritual life. The symbol of the Zulu kingdom was a twisted grass coil called the Inkatha Yowiza, the coil of the nation, which was big enough to sit in like some kind of demented rubber wing and was destroyed by the British in 1879. They didn't know they were destroying it. They were just setting fire to some huts. So this wasn't like an intentional act of cultural desecration. Those special puke holes I just mentioned were lined with straw, and the puke straw was bound into the Inkatha in order to represent the collective soul of the Zulu and the continuity of Zulu kings. The Inkatha was placed under armed guard at times. It was also because it contained filth from Zulu kings obtained during ritual ablutions, or sort of ceremonial washings by the king's attendants. And as in the European folklore that surrounds witchcraft, the Zulu believed that things like nail clippings, hair, teeth and the like could give an unscrupulous witch doctor the ability to strike at its owner. Witch doctors mucking around with people's genetic cast-offs are a little bit of a motif in African folklore. And as oral histories really account for the bulk of Zulu memory prior to Whitey turning up and writing things down helpfully, it makes these quote-unquote myths a lot closer to the surface than, say, King Arthur. So a lot of the things we're talking about are only 2 or 3 generations distant from historical record and are a pretty good lens into the beliefs and events of the societies they sprung out of. An earlier African king and Shaka's mentor, Dingiswayo, was believed to have been defeated and overthrown because his rival supplied him with a concubine who crept out once the dirty deed was done with a sample of her victim's semen in a snuff box. The semen was mixed into a special concoction which dulled the king's mind, and he wandered right into a trap set by his enemy and was killed. Organic matter that could be used for magic, such as the semen in the snuff box or the sick in the straw, was called insila, which means body dirt. Now, the role of witch doctors, or yanga, in Zulu society is interesting and complex and nuanced, and we've only really touched on it where it's relevant to warfare. There was no separation between church and state in the Zulu kingdom, and the king's every move was governed by omens, rituals, and the whispering of the witch doctors. Where there isn't anything remotely mystical, though, is in the Zulu cottage industry of murdering its own monarchs. Sir James George Frazer cites the Zulu in his epic and baffling and influential study of mythology, The Golden Bough, as evidence of the ritual killing of kings, which he believes links everything from Odin to Jesus Christ to Father Christmas. Now, it's true that Zulu kings rarely died of old age, but that's got nothing to do with the ritual rebirth of the year and everything to do with the constantly expanding warrior culture, large families produced by polygamy, and the constant jockeying of powerful chieftains and extended members of the royal family. Now, we've all had a lovely time talking about witch doctors and gassy stomach spirits, but sometimes the explanation is simply that people are, and have always been, nasty, self-centred, ruthless little pricks. Thank you so much for listening to this glorious comeback episode of History of Gore. It's just a short and sweet one, and hopefully there'll be a lot more where this came from. Now, what we talked about today is just a small part of the larger story of the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. And if you want to find out more about how the Zulu fought, weapons they used, the tactics they used, their unique history and their rise, and how the British eventually laid them low and incorporated them into South Africa, please pick up the magazine I mentioned at the start of the episode. Simply head on over to store.keypublishing.com and search for Zulu and it will pop up. Or look out for it in any WH Smiths or large newsagent. It's great to be back, and thank you for your patience and sticking with me. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or you just want to tell me I'm rubbish, you can find me on Twitter at jdhoare, H-O-A-R-E, which is spelt the Irish way and not the prostitute way. Later, folks.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.